It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfarth. In 1967, the Wilcox Expedition attacked Mount McKinley with 12 young men. Only five came back alive. The disaster was the worst in the history of the mountain and changed many lives and the way people thought about climbing. It also is a gripping and difficult story that's well worth exploring, as two authors have done in recent books. I have each of those authors on the show today, one a journalist who was the child of the park's superintendent at the time, and the other a climber who was 19 years old at the time of the disaster and was on the next climb after the Wilcox group and struggled to save those lives. So, quite a dramatic show for today's Outdoor Explorer, and in the second half we're going to be hearing from Jeff Babcock, who is the author of Should I Not Return, and was on the mountain in 1967 when those events took place. And for the first half, we have Andy Hall. And in fact, Jeff and Andy are both old friends of mine from different walks of life. And Andy is a former editor of Alaska Magazine and was well known in Anchorage. Andy, to sort of your book is Denali's Howl. It's coming out from Dutton, or has come out. Give us this sort of the overview of what happened in 1967, a long time ago, and I'm sure a lot of people have forgotten all about it.
Okay. Well, in a nutshell, the incident began with two expeditions. There was a four-man expedition, which was the Colorado Group, and a nine-man expedition, which was Wilcox. 7 hours before the Colorado Group left Colorado, they lost, a climber was injured in an accident. And suddenly they had too few people. The Park Service demanded that four people be is the minimum for an expedition. They had been communicating with Wilcox, so those two joined, and they went to Alaska together, drove the Alaska Highway, drove the Denali Highway, which was the only access to the park at the time, with the exception of the railroad, walked in together and climbed together. And after almost a month on the mountain, the party... The three Colorado guys and Joe went to the summit on the 15th of July.
Joe Wilcox.
Mm-hmm. Descended to high camp. And then 2 days later, the rest, well, with the exception of one who stayed at high camp, six guys went for the summit. The people who had been to the summit and one other guy who decided not to ascend went to 15, and this massive storm engulfed the mountain.
Which sounds like it was one of the biggest, most ferocious storms that anybody had ever seen. I mean, it sounds like a tremendously...
As far as I can tell, it was one of, if not the worst storm to hit the mountain with climbers on it. And that was after spending time with some meteorologists. Mm-hmm. And we looked at the records of the time.
Sort of one of these perfect storms where two storm systems come together and collide right on top of Denali.
Exactly.
So what was the, did the storm catch them while they were making their summit attempt?
What happened was is they went up, they got lost the night during the evening. They spent the night out. They didn't have a lot of support supplies. They had no tent. I believe they had one sleeping bag for every two guys. They got up in the morning, went for the summit, called down from the summit. And an hour later, the storm hit, from all the records I could kind of extrapolate from. Mm-hmm. And they were not seen alive again.
And wow, then, the entire party.
And then Jeff's group came up a few days later when the storm broke. And they met the survivors, but then went on up and found the bodies.
I see.
Wow. Three bodies. And they never saw the others. Just three.
And this was the greatest loss of life in the history of the mountain, from and even today.
It is. It remains that. And it's probably it was the largest loss of life in any national park at the time as well.
Wow. And this was the same year that the famous wintertime expedition took place with Art Davidson and Vern Tejas, and which led to Art's famous book -148.
Well, it was not Tejas. It was Art, Dave Johnston, and Ray Genet.
Oh, okay. Which was essentially successful, but also ran into some very difficult
conditions. They got into probably a very similar storm in a similar place. They found a way to dig a cave, and they weathered the storm in a cave. And even then, they barely made it.
Mm. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about the worst climbing disaster ever to take place on Mount McKinley. And Andy Hall is my guest for the first half. He's the author of Denali's Howl, which is just out from Dutton. What inspired you to write about this particular event?
Well, you know, my dad being the superintendent, it had been an incident that had affected him.
So you were living in the park, and your dad was running the park when this took place.
Exactly. I was five. I have some pretty fuzzy memories, but I have a few distinct memories from it. And one was this evening, which I write about, where we went in to meet somebody and walked down a riverbank, and this form emerged from the woods. And it was the first time I saw my dad scared. And we started to run, and I couldn't keep up, and he was lifting me with one arm and swinging me forward, and it really kind of shook me up, you know, because you just don't see, when your dad's freaked out, you're going to freak out too, and this thing was coming, and we thought it was a bear, and it turned out to be a climber in a giant poncho, and I just remember asking on the way back what was going on, and he told me that these men had died, or he said these boys had died. For me, I'm a boy, you know, I'm thinking a bunch of kids, you know, and then he kind of fully explained it. And it remained with me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't decide to write this until my dad had died. He'd been gone for 5 years before I did it, but I had a number of discussions with him. And then I just kind of decided I got to go start from the beginning and research.
Sounds like it took a tremendous amount of research to piece all this together.
It did. It took, I spent practically 2 years researching and a good year writing and then rewriting.
So what, these climbers were caught in this storm and obviously in that kind of severe weather without a tent, you can certainly see how they would die of exposure. Mm-hmm. Did they essentially... make a summit attempt when they shouldn't have because of the weather, or was it that they really had no way of knowing about the weather in those days?
They just didn't have a way of knowing. It was just a different time, and that was one of the things I tried hard to make it. I wanted to make it clear that this is not the mountain we know today. There are no climbing rangers. There are no high-altitude helicopters. There's no rescue. They can't even communicate. They carried CB radios, which had just been introduced. And
they're very short range. Yeah,
short. They're line of sight only. Most of the time, if there was communication, it was a single sideband, and I believe that's what Mr. Babcock's group carried. But to communicate, you had to call from the mountain. If you were in line of sight, you could talk to Eielson. You couldn't talk to Wonder Lake or headquarters, and those two places couldn't communicate. It was all relayed. And in the case of when the Babcock group was really getting involved, Jeff's brother Bill told me that they would call Fairbanks, and then Fairbanks would call Eielson, and then Eielson would call headquarters. And so there was just this really convoluted communication process. And it was, you know, there just wasn't a lot of climbing. They didn't have an infrastructure in place.
Well, nowadays we get 1,000+ climbers every year up there. But
exactly.
In those days it was just...
It was about 20. You know, if you rounded it out, it was about 20 a year. 67 had a kind of an influx because it was the centennial of Alaska or the purchase. And so there were a number of people who were doing, there were more people coming up, but it was ramping up. It was definitely getting more popular.
So they didn't really have any way of knowing. There was no localized weather forecast. And I noticed that in your book, which we get so used to our technology now that you kind of have to reset your expectations. But you talk about the fact that, you know, they were sending up weather balloons to get the weather in a couple of places. And so the idea that they would know what the weather was at any point was fantasy. That just
exactly.
wasn't the case.
And the rangers would give a report, but they got their report from listening to DJs in Anchorage.
Wow.
And that's not, you know, that could be a guy looking out the window and licking his finger and holding it up. You
right.
know? So... It was not a very exact science at the time. And even in the park, communication was limited. There were two telephones. One was on my dad's desk, which had a line to Anchorage. And I mean a line. Like, there was a single wire that went down the railroad tracks. And if it broke, the phone didn't work.
Wow.
There was another one from the reservation desk at the hotel. And in the park, we had crank telephones. I mean, my phone number was short, long, short. And
wow.
It was the box with the crank on the side, and it just worked in the park.
So about 50 years behind the times,
exactly.
Even then.
Yeah.
Well, another factor, it sounds like, is the interpersonal relations of the people on the trip. And You know, I have actually been on trips with Jeff's older brother, Bill, who was leading the Babcock expedition. And you talk in the book about how when there are people who wanted to turn back, Bill just said, okay, great. Mm-hmm. You know, go ahead back. He didn't try to force them.
Exactly.
But in the Wilcox expedition, there were some interpersonal problems, and there was and they didn't do that. They tried to just keep going onward.
Right. I thought Bill was a real nice contrast to Joe, because Bill did a lot of things right.
Mm-hmm.
He really was prepared. These guys really prepared themselves by camping, and I think he had just had more experience leading. So when somebody wanted to go, he knew, why have somebody half committed? We want to depend on everybody.
Don't try to convince them.
Right.
Yeah.
Wilcox had a lot of, you know, there were two groups that came together. In their group, there was one guy who was a bit of a troublemaker. His name was John Russell. He seemed to be at the center of most conflicts. On the other hand, they were there. Those things were in you know, part of the expedition, but I don't think they made a huge difference.
Mm.
I think if you put 12 guys together in a stressful situation, there's going to be conflict. You know,
mm-hmm.
I just think it was not unusual. And that's the other thing. If you look at the Babcock expedition, and Jeff could speak to that, I believe there was some conflict. I read the journals that were in the Grace Homan's journal. Grace Homan was Dr. Grace Jansen Homan. She was in the group. I found her journal and read it, and there was a lot of stress in that.
Mm-hmm.
She was suffering from altitude sickness, but didn't want to be left behind. And he may be able to expand on that a little bit.
So what were the main factors other than just bad luck with the weather?
I really think it was bad luck and maybe a little bit of the reality of the original Wilcox group, the nine, were really, Joe started it. He got a guy named Jerry Clark on board, and Jerry brought a lot of his friends. So it was really a group of Jerry's friends. Joe was the leader, but he wasn't a guide. You know, he wasn't a leader in the sense that he could tell somebody, you're not climbing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he told me that. He said, I was the leader because I organized it. But I think the group, there was somewhat of a fracture in the group. And
this is something that's come up on the show over and over again, is that when you're doing something challenging outdoors, somebody has to be the boss. Somebody has to, you need a single decision maker.
Right. And again, if you contrasted it with what I know of the Babcock group, when they decided they were going to go for the summit or go up and looking, you know, move quickly and look for the survivors, if there were any, he told Grace, you're not coming. And in her journal, she's not happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'd like, it'd be interesting to know, you know, what Jeff remembers from it. But there was an understanding that Bill was in charge, if I can, you know, read between the lines, and she did go down. I talked to Howard Snyder, and he said, if Joe had told me not to go, I probably would have ignored him.
Yeah.
But he never was confronted with that. He was one of the stronger climbers, and he went on to the summit and came down, and, you know.
Well, you discuss about that this group is at 18,000 feet, and they are tired. And they're resting, and so the advance party goes up first.
Right.
And that really, if you're at 18,000, resting is probably not going to do you all that much good, because the air is thin, and that's probably a good time to say, if we're not up to doing it now, we probably shouldn't do it.
Yeah, and there were people suffering, and there were people suffering from altitude sickness secretly and some openly. And one guy, who Anshul Schiff, who chose to go down, he was having indigestion. He decided to go down. He, you know, it was a decision that saved his life, but they weren't going to get any better resting. And there is, you know, I'm not a mountaineer. You know, I'm a researcher and a writer. But what I learned was, some people beat altitude sickness by speed. They get up there and they think, I'm starting to feel sick, but I can get up and back before this really debilitates me. And that's what they tried to do. And unfortunately, those guys rested, which probably didn't give them a lot of rest. They went on, they got trapped overnight, which further, you know, compromised them. Then they went to the summit, and then bad luck rolled in. And there was, you know, it's hard to know what happened. I didn't speculate myself, but I used the speculations of the people who were there.
They were weakened.
They were definitely weakened, though.
And then they were hit by this weather. Right.
Yeah.
So that's a significant contributing factor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've had that altitude sickness, the pulmonary edema, and it's very rapid, and it is similar to pneumonia. You can't breathe adequately, and you feel very, very weak and incapable. It's sort of like being suddenly another 10,000 feet higher. I would think that if you have any signs of it, you need to get down.
I would not.
I mean, keeping it a secret is a recipe for suicide, as far as I'm concerned, having experienced it.
Well, there's the factor of summit fever that comes in sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think about what those guys were doing, and you think, I've invested a lot of money. I've invested a month. I've worked my butt off to get to this, get to this point. And, when it's in sight, I've got to wonder how much that plays in. I've never been there myself, but I would think that was a factor.
Yeah. It's an outdoor explorer, a serious topic today. We're talking about the Wilcox expedition, which led to the worst disaster in the history of Mount McKinley climbing, seven dead, and the worst dead before or since. And Andy Hall has written a new book about it, called Denali's Howl, which is out from Dutton and has just been released. Andy, what is to you the most compelling part of this story? What is it that really fascinated you and made you want to know more and more and more about it?
Part of it was just the fact that my dad was involved, and at the time he was about the age that I was at, and we had talked about it a number of times, and he always said, first of all, he was a guy who let people who were good at things do those things. He wasn't a micromanager. So he was working with rescuers, the Alaska Rescue Group, the Air Force, and they had to make the calls that they, that dictated how they would do their part of the job. So he always said, what I ended up deciding was that I was trying not to kill more people in a futile attempt to get into this thing before the weather broke.
So he had to make the decision about rescuing and sacrificing the lives of those who were on the mountain, or sacrificing rescuers?
Sacrificing rescuers.
Yeah.
I mean,
if you don't rescue, it's a balance, though.
Right.
You don't know what you're...
And the reality of it is that they didn't realize, these guys disappeared. The radio calls stopped, but radios were unreliable, and radios were not relied upon. They didn't say, well, we haven't heard from these guys in 6 hours, there's a problem. They may not hear from them for a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they were gone quite a while before there was even an inkling that there was a problem.
I see. So the guys who were lower down were just hunkered down and just waiting?
Yeah, and they barely made it. I mean, Howard described to me in the midst of this windstorm, he said, I couldn't look into the wind because it would just powerhouse the air into his lungs. He couldn't turn away because it was almost like a vortex pulling air out of his lungs. So you had to position your face in a certain position.
Wow, that's incredible, isn't it?
It is. And then Bill Babcock down on the, he was on Karstens Ridge. He was watching 20-foot slabs of ice being peeled off the Harper and flung around like snowflakes. So this was an intense storm. Joe Wilcox, Howard Snyder, and Paul Schlichter tried to go up, and they spent, I think they walked, they tried to move for 4 hours and got about 100 yards or maybe a quarter of a mile from the lower camp, and realized he just said, we can't go on. Mm-hmm. And Joe made the call to go back. So the guys that were highly motivated
and fit,
close,
yeah,
and ready to go couldn't even get up there.
So no way somebody could go from base.
And
there was no high altitude chopper, not that you could fly one in those conditions,
right,
anyway.
And even the Air Force said, we're not flying. And Don Sheldon said he wouldn't fly. Mm-hmm. And in my book, if Don Sheldon says he's not going to fly, nobody's going to fly.
Right.
If you know anything about Don Sheldon.
Yeah. So when you look at this and the amount of risk these guys endured or put themselves at, in those days, I mean, it's still a very risky thing, and we still lose somebody, it seems like, every year.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, it was much more dangerous than it is now. Does it strike you like, well, why? I mean, what a horrible waste. Or do you more identify with them as you know, they're young and they want to live and take it to the limit.
I guess I kind of, the latter, you know, mm-hmm. I think people who want to climb and who do that, they're driven by something that I can't understand. I climb, you know, but I'm careful to say I'm not a mountaineer. I climb ice with a friend of mine, a guy named Charlie Cicera, and we'll be looking at the same ice fall. And he's saying, oh, we're going to go up this pillar and we're going to traverse this rocky area. And I'm looking and I'm saying, I'm going to peel off and die. I'm going to, you know, something's going to break out. I'm going to fall here. You just look, they look at the, at that differently than, mm-hmm. than somebody like me. Now, once I start, it's fun.
Uh-huh.
You become very focused and everything else doesn't matter. Mostly mm-hmm. because in my case, I don't want to die. But I think there's a part of that that you know, some of these guys just do it for reasons that are kind of incomprehensible. Now, I don't know if everybody on the Wilcox expedition felt that way. There were definitely some people who appeared to not be, to be scared, you know, to be really worried and apprehensive and maybe tentative. And
maybe this was too challenging of a climb for them to do at that level.
It could have been, but they were no less prepared than a lot of climbers who went up and had successful climbs and went on to live long and happy lives.
Mm-hmm.
I think the storm and the timing had a lot to do with it.
So you were able to read their journals of some of the climbers who did not survive, or?
Most of what I had was, I found journals of, I had Joe's journal. I talked to Joe, who is a survivor. I talked to three of the five survivors, but I found a lot of documentation, like the Park Service asked them to write accounts of what they had done immediately after, and I found those. Joe and Howard both wrote books, which conflicted in a lot of ways. I went back to the original material when I could, if I had a conflict. But I also found recordings of the radio calls. I also found that in my dad's stuff, in his storage unit, I found a tape that was an original interview of some of the members of Jeff's group.
Mm-hmm.
It was John Ireton and Chet Hackney. And they described finding the axe, finding the staff, finding the body, and then finding the two bodies up high. They descended down and looked at the bodies and described what they looked like and their, you know, kind of how they were lying. And they talked about what they thought was happening. And I did, you know, a lot of original material like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons were learned, or what kind of changes took place after this incident? Did it have a big influence?
I think it did. I don't think it was apparent immediately. Right afterward, Wayne Mary was the Wonder Lake District Ranger, and he was a rock climber. He hadn't been on the mountain, and he wasn't an alpine mountaineer, but he was very, I think he connected with the climbers in a big way, and I did go interview him. He felt that a flight should have gone during the storm, but he was isolated at Wonder Lake, and he had a limited view of the mountain. But afterward, I think he pushed for some changes. He left the Park Service. And I think it was a couple of years before they started to realize that this was going to become a big part of what Mount McKinley National Park, and later now called Denali National Park, would become.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started developing, you know, licensing of guides. Ray Janae started guiding right after that. Then they realized if we've got a commercial activity here, we've got to have some support. And then climbing rangers and a climbing program. So it happened, but it happened as the demand grew. I don't know how quickly it happened after the accident. It seems like it immediately didn't change things. But I'd say within a couple of years, they started developing a climbing program.
Well, it's a somewhat perverse thing. We would think that a disaster like that would drive people off and make them not want to climb the mountain, but it may be the reverse. It sort of highlights the challenge and brings more attention to the mountain.
I think it did. You know, people climbed a day later. You know, there was the Western States expedition on the other side of the mountain. They went up to the summit. You know, climbers kept climbing. There was definitely some issues in the National Park Service management, and I get into that toward the end of the book. The regional director wanted to close the mountain, and the climbing community here knew about it and were trying to fight it. And
no one could ever climb it again.
Right. And I had heard that. My dad told me that, but I didn't want to write it because it was just, you can't just write it.
Incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to corroborate it. I did, but I found a man in town named Frank Nosek, who is a practicing attorney. He was the head of the MCA at the time, Mountaineering Club of Alaska. And he told me the story, and he said, we knew this director had said, close the mountain. And, my dad wouldn't do it. And it's a funny thing about being a superintendent, you have some authority that your boss doesn't have. Mm. So he was the immediate director. He said no. And he just held his ground. And after it, the pain, kind of the hubbub died away. As winter set in, he withdrew his demand. And because of that, the MCA gave my dad an honorary lifetime membership.
Wow.
But I never knew, I didn't put the pieces together until I was researching the book. Mm-hmm. And it was something I wanted to know about. And I found Frank, and he said, I remember your dad, come on down, and went to his office, and he told me the whole story. I then found some tapes that were done by park historians where they interviewed my dad, and he commented on it some more. So I was able to tell it from a pretty substantial, research basis, rather than just say my dad told me.
Right. And what was your father's name?
George Hall.
All right. Sounds like he's a piece of Alaska history that most people didn't know about.
Yeah.
So you've recovered some of that.
A little
bit.
Book. Yeah. It's kind of neat to find something like that.
So you're headed off on a book tour, and and the book is available, Denali's Howl by Andy Hall from Dutton. And what's the subtitle?
The Deadliest Climbing Disaster on America's Wildest Peak.
All right. Well, good luck with the book, and thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking to Jeff Babcock, who was on the mountain, and as Andy was talking about, was part of that party that came up after the Wilcox party and recovered some of the bodies or found some of the bodies. And Jeff is also the author of a book. His book is called Should I Not Return? But first, it's time for a quick break. If you climb Denali with a commercial outfitter, you can expect to shell out about $7,000 to $10,000 for the trip. But not everyone does it that way. And KSKA producer Dave Waldron caught up with Luke Mell, an Alaskan adventurer who's mastered the art of mountaineering on the cheap. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort.
Luke Mell has lived in Alaska most of his life, and he doesn't waste an opportunity to be outdoors.
I think I went three years straight where I was out of town every weekend.
Every single weekend.
Yeah, and not an overnighter, but yeah, going somewhere Saturday, going somewhere Sunday.
Mel has gone on just about every kind of Alaskan adventure you could think of, from skiing down volcanoes to pack rafting through craters. Most recently, he traversed and climbed the three largest peaks in North America. That's more than 800 miles of hiking, biking, skiing, and rafting. Now, you might be thinking at this point that Mel has to be a dentist or a lawyer that can afford to blow money on big elaborate trips, and you wouldn't be the first. He recalls a comment someone made after seeing a video of one of his trips.
Boy, you guys must be really wealthy to pull off these trips. And my jaw just dropped because, man, he has no idea. Like, we're all scraping by.
Mel is actually a teacher at the Alaska Pacific University. He is by no means wealthy, but he doesn't let that stop him from taking seemingly expensive trips.
You actually can save a lot of money if you're doing all the work.
For his Denali trip, he says the biggest way he and his friends saved money was biking to the base of the mountain instead of flying, and by packing their food for the entire month instead of relying on food drops by helicopter.
So by cutting that out of the loop, we save a lot of money, and there just really isn't a lot of expense beyond that. Basic food, fuel.
Mel says if planned properly, food can be very cheap, right around $5 a day. As for the fuel aspect, Mel sticks to biking and rafting as much as he can to cut travel costs. Maybe you're thinking, okay, what about gear? That's not cheap.
Initially, when I couldn't afford gear, I borrowed everything for years. And then now that I've been able to afford a bunch of that equipment, I'm in the role where I can lend it out to people that don't have it.
I decided to check out Mel's house to see this gear swap-eration for myself.
This is all other people's gear or my gear that I need to sell or repair. I usually have a pile of stuff that I'm like, oh, whose house am I going to? Maybe I can return some of their things. Because it all just sort of migrates between our households.
Mel's living room, which he jokingly refers to as his garage, has just about every kind of outdoor toy you could think of. Some of it's borrowed, some of it Mel has fixed up. and this bike frame.
This was on Craigslist, and I emailed the guy. I said, oh, I'm interested in your frame. And then it turned out it was a friend. He's like, hi, Luke. Okay, I'll give you it for $50 instead of $107, like three times.
Totes packed full of equipment line one of the walls.
So, bike parts, looking forward to getting in here in the next couple weeks.
Mel will often use a piece of equipment as a multitasker to save money or weight, like a tent pole as an avalanche probe or a pair of modified ski poles as a raft paddle. Of course, Mel and his crew have to splurge at least once in a while. On one trip, Mel noticed his friend's raft had been packed awkwardly, and out of the goodness of his heart, he decided to repack it.
And then when I unrolled it all the way, I discovered a little hidden bottle of liquor in there, and that's why it looked so sloppy, and he was hiding it because he knew I was the one that would probably say, man, we can't afford that extra weight.
For KSKA, I'm Dave Waldron.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about Mount McKinley, about the worst climbing disaster ever to hit the mountain. It happened in 1967. The Wilcox expedition lost seven climbers out of 12 who were on the expedition. And there's been a lot said about this expedition years ago, obviously. It's happened quite a long time ago. But two books have come out recently. In the first half, we heard from Andy Hall, who's the author of Denali's Howl. And now we're privileged for the second half of the show to have someone who was there. Jeff Babcock was a member of the expedition that came up right behind the disastrous expedition and was involved in trying to rescue and assist the climbers in that disastrous Wilcox party. And Jeff is the author of also author of a book called Should I Not Return, and he's joining us by phone. Thanks very much for being with us, Jeff.
You bet, Charles.
You were 19 years old, and your brother Bill, I guess, is about a decade older than you are. Tell us about how how your trip came together in '67. Had you climbed high altitude peaks previously?
No. I was a novice. You know, I hadn't done anything like that.
And so Bill put together this trip, which was pretty challenging. You went all the way from Wonder Lake. You didn't get dropped off halfway up the mountain, as most people do these days.
Correct. Yeah. Bill was real interested in doing it the way the Pioneer climbers had done it. So, yeah, he wanted to do it that way. I flew in from the East Coast, actually. I'd done some rock climbing and, you know, winter climbing and quite a bit of hiking and climbing with Bill, you know, prior to this. So, I wasn't a total novice, but I'd never done anything high altitude-wise.
So it seems like it must have been a very difficult thing to go back and dredge up these memories and explore what must have been an extremely traumatic event in your life when you decided to write the book.
Well, that you hit the nail on the head. That was the main focus for me. You know, I've been trying to write the book for the better part of my adult life. You know, I did move to Alaska in '72, and several different times I toyed with trying to. It's more of an autobiography. You know, the Wilcox disaster is certainly the focal point which the book revolves around. But it's much more of an autobiography, a coming of age story for me, and actually a merging of two expeditions. I've been on McKinley three times, and I led a 10 years after that, I led an expedition in 77 where we followed the actual routes of Belmore Brown and started from up the highway where that huge big igloo hotel is mm-hmm. on the Parks Highway.
Right.
We actually started there, got off by the train, and so I was advised by people that had I've written a screenplay, and they said, look, you've got to put it into a smaller one group, one expedition with a smaller number of people. I was trying to do two storylines at one point, and so that's what I did in my book, was merged the two expeditions together. But the tragedy, you know, was the one that was necessary for me, which is the reason I went back, you know, 10 years later to confront my worst fears.
Yeah.
You know, that I had experienced in 67. Yeah.
Well, I can only imagine. If you would, could you take us through the events of those days? You were pretty advanced when this up the mountain when the storm hit, were you not?
Yeah, we had moved up. We had gotten up the Muldrow Glacier, and we were up. We weren't able to get up on Karstens Ridge, which is the technical section of the Muldrow route. It's about a 4,000-foot ridge climb, and there's one camping area up there at 12,100 feet, and that's where we were when the five survivors, Joe and the Colorado guys and Ansel, came down and met us. So yeah, and prior to that, we had, as Andy had explained, you know, we had been seeing these horrific winds coming off of the harbor above us, and you know, I have vivid recollections of, you know, trying to keep our tents up on Karstens Ridge and having to drop them and dig into the slope, and it was just terrifying. You know, it was the way I describe it is you're on this ridge and you can't keep your tents up, the poles go, you know, so we drop the tents, and it's almost like having two locomotive trains on both sides of you when the winds come in. And as Andy had said, you can't breathe, you can't stand, and it's just a terrifying, terrifying experience to be in.
I can't even imagine. So
it was. I had never, you know, I was terrified, and then it cleared. We were able to move up to the 12-1 shelf, and that's when the Wilcox survivors came down to us.
So by that time, the storm had died. Well, how long was that wind blowing? I mean, how long were you pinned down?
We were roughly a week on Karstens. I mean, it was a 9-day storm. Wow. And we were able to move things up to there's a little shelf at 11,500 feet. And that's where we established a cache, got everything moved up to there. And even though the weather was, you know, we were kind of in this little hollow where the head of the Muldrow Glacier is. And so we were pretty much out of the wind, but we were being dumped on with snow. So the ridge was incredibly avalanche prone. So to get up to that 12,100 foot shelf was really, really dangerous. And in fact, we kicked off an avalanche on the way up there. It was just way beyond anything I had anticipated. So it was overwhelming for me. You know, and like I said, I had never done anything like that.
So it's harrowing even to hear you tell about it. So when you met the climbers coming down, they said, you know, we're missing these other climbers. What was the decision process you made at that point?
Well, we knew there was 12 above us. You know, Wayne Mary back at the park had told us about them. And, you know, so we were anticipating 12 people coming down, and only five did. And Bill got us together, and we went up to, there's a place where Elton Thayer died back in 54, where he peeled off. He was the third person to die on Denali. And it's kind of an icy stretch, about 60, 70 feet high, and he fell off of there with his climbers and died. And that's where we met the Wilcox survivors. And Bill went up and met them. Joe was the first one. And then I was about 60 feet down on the shelf, and then one by one, Bill belayed each of them down. And the weather was not good. I mean, we were in a snowstorm, and there were winds, and, you know, it was not ideal conditions by a long shot. And I remember those guys looked like they'd been through hell. It was like literally like seeing Holocaust survivors, or it was awful. I mean, it was just so, you know, terrifying, unbelievable. You know, I'm sitting there going, what the heck am I doing here?
Yeah, that's when I'd want to turn around and run, but you decided to keep going up.
Exactly. Yeah. And Grace, you know, like which Andy had mentioned, you know, is coughing up sputum with blood streak sputum, so she's having the altitude problems that you guys were talking about with pulmonary and cerebral edema, pulmonary edema in this case. So Grace is, you know, coughing and spitting up, you know, and Bill's saying, you know, Grace, this is not good. So when the five guys got down, we set up tents, and you know, and it was just this horrific. Depression kind of settled over all of us because we knew there were still seven climbers above, and what was going to happen? What are we going to do?
Did you think there was any chance of them having survived at that point, or was it sort of like there's no way these guys are alive?
It was hard to say because, you know, there have been, and there was even in those days, incidents where people had dropped into crevasses up on the Harper and had sat out storms. I don't think anything as terrifying as this 9-day storm that hit the mountain. I think Andy was correct in saying it was the worst, you know, it was the perfect storm, like the book that was mm-hmm. written about on the East Coast. I was put into Howard, the Colorado guy's tent. Jerry Lewis had frostbitten feet, and he was put into the tent with Grace and Bill and me. And I remember that sitting in there with Howard and Paul Schlichter, and Howard was just, you know, he was just so gone. And he had kind of held things together. And, you know, Joe was having his problems with feet, with altitude, his hands. You know, there were issues that all of them were struggling with. Mm-hmm. And Howard just, he let loose that night, you know, and I became kind of a sounding board. And I vividly remember that, how angry and depressed and, it was just horrible. You know, it was, and I'm, like I said, yeah, it was
tough. Terrible. Yeah. So it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking about the 1967 disaster on Mount McKinley with Jeff Babcock, who was there. And the next party that came up behind those climbers who had been in this terrible storm, and then Jeff, you went. And Jeff is the author of Should I Not Return? That's his book, which you can find on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just take a look at today's show, McKinley Disaster. So Jeff, take the story onward. You continued up to see if you could find any sign of life or to find out at least what had happened.
Yeah. The park told us to make a beeline, you know, which again was, in retrospect, probably not the wisest choice to make. So we gave up relaying. Generally, high altitude teams relay and then they can acclimatize better. But we left our tents at 12:01. We used snow shovels and the snow saws, and the idea was we were going to be constructing snow caves and igloos as we went on up the mountain. And we made it to the top of Carson's Ridge that night, and again it was terrible. We had a bivouac below Brown Tower, right up at the top there, and the ice was so hard you couldn't even get in. You know, we dug out these little, probably similar to what Clark's team had to do up on the Archdeacon's Tower, hollow out these kind of cave like things that you could crunch into. You know, and it was horrible. You know, I had this horrendous nightmare where the corpse of Elton Thayer came up Carson's Ridge and, you know, told us not to go on. It was just horrific. You know,
for fear of running out of time, it was really important
for me to go back. You know,
yeah. And I want to get back to the aftermath. So for fear of running out of time, what was the you got up to that point where those poor guys had been trapped, and how did you find them?
Well, we got to, you know, 15-1, which is where the five survivors had stayed. Then we continued on up, and, you know, 2 or 3 days after that, we got to the high camp. We found an ice axe that had been left probably by Steve Taylor, who apparently, I think Andy probably covers that in his book, had come down during the storm. Then we eventually got to the 17,900-foot camp, and we found the corpse of who they believed to be was John Russell, the fellow who had created friction within the Wilcox team. He did not. He went up. Steve Taylor was left at 17.9 when Clark's group went up. And then when they got had to bivouac below Archdeacon's Tower because of the weather, you know, they woke up the next morning, they figured out where they were, and then they went ahead on up. Not all of them, but five of them went up, and Russell came down to 17.9. And so Wilcox believes it was Russell's body that we found at 17.9. And the ice axe that was partway down the Harper Glacier probably belonged to Steve Taylor. Now, the thing that I need to emphasize, and I know Bill probably shared this with you, Charles, is we were all really hurting numbers, you know, because we were not climbing the mountain accordingly in terms of acclimatizing appropriately. And Gail Nienhauser was similarly coughing up blood and sputum in the snow. I had these incredible headaches, and all of us were just barely surviving as we pushed our way up, you know, reached the high camp, and found the corpse. And the corpse was, you know, such a terrible omen of, you know, what could easily happen to us at the time. I know there's been a lot of criticism, you know, that arrows shot at everybody, including ourselves, you know, for not staying and, you know, and carrying the bodies down and all that. It was just, a terrible, terrible experience for everybody involved.
And you were just, you were at the brink of exhaustion at that altitude from kind of a crazy...
Yeah, I mean, it took us, you know, just to tell you, like at 17.9, we're looking at, you know, four hours to construct snow caves after we've climbed up to that point. You know, and then we get up at 3 o'clock the next morning, and we continue on up to the south summit to look for any signs of anybody after that. The Air Force plane, a C-130 from the Air Force, made the highest rescue attempt ever in the history of the United States. They dropped all these parachutes, and, they made 10 drops as we were going up Denali Pass, in an attempt if we did find anybody alive, to have supplies and provisions for them. Of course, it was all we could do to carry what we had.
Right.
And we did not find anything other than, you know, on the way up, and then, like Andy said, Chet and John and Don Sheldon were overhead, and sure enough, he dropped us an apple. Are you still there?
Yep, we're here.
Yeah.
So, what about the other three bodies? Where were those found?
We only found two. You know, it was below Archdeacon's Tower. We were coming down from the south summit. John and Chet were, there's a big plateau like a football field just below the summit at 19,500 feet. Chet and John were waiting there, and Sheldon was flying that day because the weather was, you know, reasonable, so he could do that. He dropped an apple and told us that, you know, that he had spotted bright colors below Archdeacon's Tower. And then Chet and John opted to, Bill was, and we had a weather front moving in on us at the same time. It was just, it was pretty crazy. It really was. Chet and John went down, you know, and checked out the bodies. And obviously Andy, from the recording, you know, and I knew that when we got back that they had done that. But Bill and Gail and I continued on down, you know, to the pass, but the winds picked up and we were in whiteout conditions. And just by the grace of God, we all got back to the, you know, we were in a complete whiteout when we got to the Denali Pass, and we still had, you know, 200 yards to get down to where our snow caves were, which you couldn't see. And it was just terrifying. It was crazy.
I can't imagine.
And I can see, you know, how you know, it makes perfect sense, you know, how horrific the whole thing would have been for those guys, the seven guys that were left behind.
What a way to die.
Because
yeah,
they had 100-150 mile-an-hour winds. You know, it was just outrageous.
So I'm talking to Jeff Babcock, the author of Should I Not Return, and it just strikes me that the title of your book is so apropos, because I after the experience you're talking about, it's very hard to imagine returning. And so talk about that, about how you got through this trauma of this terrifying and very, very deeply sad experience
I had to go back. I mean, I knew that. And Bill and I, you know, taught climbing classes at the university for, 20 some odd years. And part of my desire was to to lead a team, you know, 10 years later. And that was the, and I became really interested in the history of the mountain too. And the, so my book's very, very heavily, has a lot to do with the pioneer climbs and following those routes. Yeah, it was necessary for me to go back and to revisit that whole experience. And, you know, Charles, the craziest thing happened, you know, after we were 68 days, took us a month to get to the mountain. We had a collision with the Alaska Railroad. One of our dog teams was hit right at the onset of our climb in 77. Dogs were killed. The sled was demolished. So we had to ferry stuff 45 miles to the base of the mountain. Took us a month to get there. Then we finally got up high on the mountain and climbed the peaks, dropped down to 17.2, and we were hit by this incredible storm at 17.2. And our tents were blown apart. And just by sheer luck, there was an igloo that had been left there at 17,200 feet. And the eight of us ended up cramping into that igloo, a small igloo, no larger than, you know, a small kitchen or, you know, large bathroom, something like that. And we stayed there for 5 days as this horrific storm raged overhead. And so I had visions of, you know, the same thing happening to us. And it was only, you know, again, like I said, by the grace of God that we were able to descend. We did a traverse, drop down the west buttress side. But at that point in time, we were all dehydrated. Fortunately, no frostbite. But it was quite a ordeal, to say the least. And I had to write about all of this. You know, it was too much of a coincidence. The two climbs, and so that's basically what my book is about. You know, mm-hmm. It's my experiences on Denali, and culminating or beginning with the terrible Wilcox tragedy as a young novice climber.
Well, explain for those of us who find it incomprehensible to put yourself even one time into such a dangerous situation, but for a second time after going through such a terrifying thing. What is the draw? What makes it important enough to do that?
Well, I believe, you know, it's climbing, you know, the risk-taking factor. You know, a large part of my book is why people like my brother and myself, you know, flirt with danger. Why anybody that does that sort of a thing. I basically see it as another form of addiction and addictive behavior. And, you know, we put ourselves in these positions, you know, and man against nature. And, you know, it's something that people choose to do, you know, and as crazy as it sounds. Confrontation with death, you know, whether or not you can survive, how capable you are under those situations to be able to survive and come back alive. And so the title of my book, you know, I met with Dennis Luchterhand's younger sister when Andy was talking about when we all got together. And I can read a brief section of my conversation with her for my book, and it stuck with me ever since it happened, and there's a picture in my book that shows, you know, George Hall and Joe Wilcox, and then several of the families that were still the people that came to, you know, hoping that their sons would come down from the mountain, which they did not. Here we go. Is that okay if I read just a brief section?
Sure.
Okay. It was my final confrontation with death on Denali. I remember how the teenage sister of Dennis Luchterhand sat with me outside of Park Superintendent George Hall's rustic-looking front porch. I remember to this day how she looked at me with those sad eyes. Her parting words struck a chord with me, which is as heartfelt for me today as it was then, and I will never forget what she said. You know, I really think that Dennis would have preferred it this way. I mean, being left up there on the mountain instead of having his body brought down back here. Her eyes moistened, as did mine, and I felt a lump forming in my throat as she continued to tell me about her older brother. He once said to me jokingly, should I not return, what better place could there be than up there for me to die? Dennis's sister stopped for a few moments so she could regain her composure. I mean, Dennis really loved the mountains. Canal, you know, a final mountaintop in the clouds where he can live on into eternity. Seems only fitting to me that he should have the top of Mount McKinley as his final resting place. She looked at me again with those sad eyes. Don't you think that's a good thing? In a way, it makes me feel better. You know what I mean? Hmm. And that actually happened, you know, and I remember that vividly.
Wow, I can imagine that.
Yeah.
And that was Jeff Babcock reading from his book, Should I Not Return, about the disaster that happened in 1967 on Mount McKinley. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Jeff, I wanted to, in just a couple minutes we have left, Andy Hall earlier in the show talked about the leadership skills of your brother Bill and the things that you guys did right. Do you feel like there was a contrast between your expedition and the Wilcox expedition and Bill's leadership and the way that expedition was structured that could have made a difference?
I think Bill's was largely responsible for getting us back down safely, very much so. You know, he talked Grace into going down, which was a smart thing. It was real difficult with Gail Niedhauser up high because we didn't want to leave him alone. So that was a struggle, you know, and Gail went with us all the way to the top of the South Summit. So that was an issue that was very hard to compromise on, you know. And Bill said we've got to stay with him. In fact, Bill and I, we were a rope team. Chet and John, actually made it to the summit before we did, and so we were pretty much Bill and I were. And I was having problems too. It wasn't like I was having an easy time of it either. So yeah, Bill certainly was a very capable leader. I think part of the conflict with the Wilcox, and if you read the earlier books, Joe's book and Howard's, you'll see that there's a definite personality issue between the two of them. And Howard's book is almost vindictive, you know, in terms of pointing the finger at Joe as being responsible for poor Joe, you know, had rest. Bulk of his life was, you know, in the shadow of being responsible for these guys dying. I think Tabor's book, Forever on the Mountain, you know, addressed some of those issues where they needed, you know, they unfortunately needed, you know, when Washburn was called into, Brad Washburn, the grandfather of Denali, was called into Anchorage that fall, you know, they needed questions answered. And I think Joe got a bad rap, or whatever you want to call it. And unfortunately, for years, you know, everybody, when you talked about the Wilcox team, everybody thought it was Joe Wilcox's fault for why that happened. And that's not the case. That's not the case at all.
And now we're out of time.
Within the group.
And I want to thank you, Jeff, for being with us. No, you did a wonderful job, and it was just a fascinating interview. And where there's a link to Jeff Babcock's book, Should I Not Return, as well as earlier in the hour we heard from Andy Hall, his book, Denali's Howl, on our website at alaskapublic.org. Thanks so much for being with us, Jeff.
You bet, Charles.
All right.
Take care.
Next week's show, we're talking a lighter topic. We're going to be talking about fishing charters, so please join us next week on Outdoor Explorer. Thanks for joining us this week. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.